The moment has arrived. The moment you've all been waiting for. Now, you've all read the flyer, so you know all about Michael Lestrange, and you know all about what he's going to talk about. But just to refresh your memory, let me, by way of introduction, say that Michael Lestrange has had a highly distinguished career in public administration and government in Canberra. He is currently the director of the National Security College at the ANU, and has been director of the Menzies Research Centre, secretary to Federal Cabinet, head of the Cabinet Policy Unit, High Commissioner to the United Kingdom, and until mid-2009, secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. So he is uniquely placed to talk about Australia's national security challenges. The title is Australia's National Security Challenges, A New World Coming. I suppose the big question is it a new world coming, Michael? And you're going to tell us all about that. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Les, and thank you all for your invitation today and for the very warm welcome that you've extended to me. It's a great pleasure for me to come down to Melbourne today to accept this invitation, and I'm delighted to see a number of very familiar faces around the table, which bring back memories, good and bad, but certainly good to see them, and the memories are all my fault. But can I say, part of the honour I feel in coming here today is that this organisation has played such a critical role over such a long period, more than 8 decades, of community involvement in debates around public policy issues, and particularly Australia's place in the world. So to come to the Victorian branch of the Institute is a great pleasure and great honour, and I'm delighted to be able to address the rather curly question that Les and his senior officers have posed to me about the challenges and the opportunities that exist in Australian national security policy making over the period ahead in the new world that is coming. I think that as I approach this task today, the most important attribute that I or anybody else can bring to it is that of perspective. Perspective is very important, I think, in avoiding the delusion that no challenges that we face in international relations today have any precedence on which to draw, that they've got no historical experience from which we can learn. It was Mark Twain that once wrote that history doesn't repeat itself, but it can rhyme. And I think perspective gives us a great help in working out where history is rhyming at the present time. A sense of perspective is also very important because I think it focuses on the essential question, and that is, what is changing in relation to Australia's national security circumstances and what is not? It's easy but mistaken to believe that we live in a world in which very little, if anything, in our national security circumstances can ever be the same in the future as they've been in the past. It is true that the pace of change in international affairs and national security is intense, that it's accelerating, and that its consequences are transformative. And I'll be focusing today on some aspects of that transforming change in terms of Australia's international circumstances. But it's as big a mistake to believe that everything has changed as it is to believe that nothing has changed. And it's perspective that provides the essential insights into the linkages and connections between our past experience in national security policymaking and our future challenges and opportunities. So what then are some of these continuing realities in a world of transforming change? One is that Australia has always had global interests as well as regional priorities in national security, and that will continue in the future. We have never been a nation of regional isolationists. Geography alone has never defined our interests, and it won't in the future. Another dimension of continuity lies in the sources of instability, tension and conflict among states. In the past, Many of those sources related to historical antagonisms, territorial disputes, religious rivalry, nationalist claims, resource competition, and ethnic animosities. Those sources of instability, tension, and conflict between and within states have not been swept away on some high tide of multilateralism. They persist, and they will continue to do so in the future as they have in the past. No doubt in different forms, but with no less intensity. At another level, we hear and read a lot these days about the limitations on the utility of military force in international affairs. And there's no doubt that there are new and important constraints on how military force can be legitimately engaged and effectively applied. But none of that diminishes the ongoing relevance of military alliances between states or partnerships of security cooperation in which many states engage. Alliances and security partnerships will, in my view, constitute another dimension of strategic continuity rather than discontinuity in the era ahead. These are important elements of continuity in our national security environment, and there are many others which are too often neglected. But for all the significance of the continuities that exist, it's the dynamics of change in Australia's national security circumstances that are transforming the focus of Australian policy making. And I believe that these forces of change affecting Australia's national security interests are operating at two levels. One is systemic in terms of how international relations generally are changing and what impact it's having on Australia. At a second level, there are changes in power relativities among states that are changing the perceptions of risk and opportunity in the national security strategies of many countries, including Australia. The first of these forces of change affecting Australia's national security interests, those relating to the international system, are evident in a variety of ways. One is the shifting balance of wealth and power from west to east, which is apparent and which is set to accelerate. This shift is clearly apparent in the patterns of growth in trade, investment, and productive economic capacity. It's also relevant in the global economy, with the dynamic economies of the developing world so critical to the capacity of developed economies, particularly in Europe and the United States, to respond effectively to the very serious challenges that they currently face. But all this is symptomatic of an even more fundamental development. For the first time in 300 or 400 years, the ascendancy of Western countries in the institutions, conventions, and values of the international system are in relative decline. That's partly a result of the rise of China and India, the indices of which are apparent in so many ways, but the one that always captures my attention is that between 2005 and 2010, in purchasing power parity terms, the Eurozone grew by 15%. The United States by 16%. By contrast, India grew by 67% and China by 88%. This decline of the West in international institutions is also a result of the economic dynamism of Asia. Asia's share of global GDP will nearly double between now and the middle of this century. Added to this, there is a rising voice for the aspirations of the developing world generally. This shift in patterns of growth and productivity and influence is not just an economic phenomenon. It is shifting the balance of power generally. And the era ahead is one that I think will see geopolitics and geoeconomics intersect in new and transforming ways. The economic circumstances of some states, particularly in Europe, will significantly constrain their defence and security influence, while in other states, particularly in Asia, their economic circumstances will create strategic opportunities. A second systemic change influencing Australia's international interests is the evolution of economic globalisation. On balance, no other process of change throughout history has brought more people more quickly out of poverty than the processes of economic globalisation over the past three decades. But there is a backlash, both in developed countries and developing countries. In developed countries, the pressures of the economic downturn during and after the global economic crisis has led to rising voices of economic protectionism as a result. In developing countries, there is significant resentment against ways in which economic globalisation has operated, what many see as the unequal access that they have had to its benefits, and the changes in traditional cultural practices underpinning economic production in many countries. In my view, we've reached the end of one phase in the modern evolution of economic globalisation, and we are at the beginning of another more difficult and more contested period. A third systemic change affecting Australian interests lies in the broadening dimensions of national security itself. National security for all states has developed beyond the traditional focus on border security, territorial integrity, and hard power capabilities. National security now embraces a wider range of issues on which the capacity of any nation acting independently to achieve the outcomes it wants has significantly diminished. For all states, these transnational issues are becoming more prominent as national security interests. They include international terrorism, the proliferation of weapons and technologies of mass destruction, disputes over the global commons, at sea, in space, and on land, people smuggling, international criminal networks, pandemic contingencies, climate change, cybersecurity, security of access to energy, water, and food resources, and a range of other concerns. And because of this changing framework of how nations view their national security interests, one result is that the limits of sovereign decision-making are becoming more apparent, at the same time as the constraints on multilateralism increasingly inhibit its effectiveness. And in that context, we need look no further than the WTO Doha Round and the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit. This is the uncomfortable space between the limits of sovereignty and the constraints of multilateralism in which Australia and many other countries now find themselves. A fourth aspect of change in the international system which is affecting our strategic environment are the new sources of instability and insecurity. At one level, there's the proliferation of vulnerable, failed, failing and rogue states. These have always existed in the international system. It's just now there's more of them, and they have greater capacity for destabilisation, from Yemen to Somalia and from North Korea to Iran. There's also the increasingly asymmetrical power of non-state actors. Again, they've always existed in the international system. It's just now there's more of them, they're more lethal and more violent, and they're more joined up. Cyber insecurity is another evolving source of instability in the international system. It's impacting on relations between states, on their military capabilities and their diplomatic exchanges. It's impacting on the vulnerability of critical national infrastructure, including power, water and other utilities. Cyber insecurity is part of a broader trend in communications globally, with the impact of new media, new technologies, social media, which were evident in the Arab Spring. The BBC commentator Nick Gowan wrote an excellent book recently called Skyfall of Lies and Black Swans, The New Tyranny of Shifting Information Power in Crises, which emphasised the importance of the communication between people as opposed to communication between governments. Hillary Clinton has called this the connection technology and building blocks of 21st century statecraft. It is changing the nature of diplomacy and information. It is blurring the lines between foreign policy and domestic policy. In addition to these changes in the international system in relation to wealth and power, economic globalisation, the broadening of national security, and the new agents of instability and insecurity, there is a second dimension of change, which is also shaping the new contours of Australia's strategic environment. And that is the changing relativities among the established and emerging powers of the Asia-Pacific region, and in particular, the United States, China, Japan, and India. Of these changing power relativities, the single most significant determinant of regional and global strategic circumstances is that between the United States and China. And for Australia, that intersection of interests and strategic objectives between the US and China has a special relevance. We are an alliance partner of 60 years standing with the United States, with critically important cooperation in diplomacy, intelligence, defence interoperability, trade and investment. We also share vital and expanding bilateral linkages with China, and significantly wider associations of interest through regional cooperation and regional institutions. This is the first time in our history that our major security partner and our major economic partner are not the same country. And it's put into high profile the nature of our relationship with each, particularly following the visit by President Obama, to which I'll return later. There's been much analysis and speculation about a range of futures which could characterise the US-China relationship over coming decades. Some believe the future belongs to power sharing, either between the US and China as a group of two, or as part of a wider concert of power in the Asia-Pacific or the Indo-Pacific. Others believe the future belongs to Chinese primacy accelerating and US decline continuing. Others again believe in a different future, in policies of containment of China. Others despair completely and say that we'll all end in tears, in crisis and confrontation. My view is that none of the above are the most likely outcomes. I think what's most likely in the future is a circumstance in which China and the United States will cooperate on some issues and compete on others in ways that are different to power sharing and that recognise both shared and competing interests. In this debate about the most likely future for US-China relations and Australia's place in it, I think there are some broad areas of consensus between people with different perspectives which are focused on too little. I think there is a broad consensus that the strategic future of the Asia-Pacific region will certainly be more contested, more complex, and more uncertain than in the recent past. It's a broad consensus that neither the US nor China will be able to dominate the other. It's a broad consensus that most major global public policy issues will require some level of US and Chinese understanding, either explicit or implicit, for their resolution. There's broad consensus that China's power is expanding as a result of its economic weight, its diplomatic activism, its military modernisation, its role in regional and global institutions, and its occasional brinkmanship and coercion. And I think there is a broad consensus that US primacy in the Asia-Pacific region, as we have known it, is declining in relative terms. Where the consensus breaks down is in relation to the consequences of these changes for the security order of the Asia-Pacific region, and for Australian policy priorities in particular. And let me cut through to my bottom line conclusions on these areas of contention. First, I think it is as unproductive to overreact or to exaggerate perceived strategic change as it is to pretend that real change is not occurring at all. Second, there is, in my view, no defining choice to be made by Australia now or into the foreseeable future between its alliance relationship with the US and its economic and wider engagement with China. Third, the exchanges of information and perspective between the US and China across all areas of public policy, including security policy, is intensive and influential. Some of it is conducted in the public gaze, most of it is conducted away from the limelight. This is not tantamount to a G2 arrangement or to some shared leadership model, but it is highly significant and needs to be factored in. Fourth, China's recent economic growth is without historical precedent, and it is set to continue into the future, though not at the same high levels as the recent past, and with more cyclical variations. But China's economic rise will change the strategic status quo in the Asia Pacific, and China will seek to extend its strategic influence at America's expense. But I think it's critical to remember in all of this that US-China relations are not a zero-sum game. Their relationship reflects important dimensions of interdependence as well as significant independent capabilities. China has a vital interest in avoiding regional and global disorder. They are, as they keep telling us, the world's largest developing country. They have structural economic imbalances and resource constraints. They have a real challenge in terms of social stability, employment growth, and ethnic divisions. The most fundamental challenge they face is that of sustaining both a system of economic liberalism and political authoritarianism. China faces the challenge of massive structural adjustment as it makes the next great leap forward from an investment-led growth to a consumption-led growth, from a low-cost, labour-intensive manufacturing growth model to a model focused on capital, services, and knowledge. This has very significant implications for China's currency valuation, its transparency generally, the rule of law, and its approach to innovation and internet freedom. It will require changes in the Chinese wage system, welfare system, and financial sector liberalisation. In all of these challenges, China will need the United States, and it will need developed countries as much as it needs dynamism in developing countries. The Secretary of the Commonwealth Treasury made an important speech some weeks ago in which he said that people focus on the way in which China is changing the world. He also emphasised that the world is changing China. The reason why US-China relations are not a zero-sum game is also because the United States has a clear interest in avoiding an ongoing escalating tension with China. The US faces its own major structural adjustment as it seeks to overcome its domestic fiscal problems and as it works with China and other countries to open further international trade and investment flows. But the US knows that negotiating or working with China from a position of weakness dooms it to failure. It's important to recall that on strategic issues, the US decline is relative, not absolute. In 2010, of all global defence expenditure, the United States expended 43% of the world's total defence expenditure. China, less than 7%. China's military modernization will constrain and or complicate US strategic policy, but it's important to keep it in perspective and the base from which it is starting. US maritime superiority, for example, in the Pacific, is not being seriously contested and will continue for many years to come. Furthermore, the United States is not going soon or easily to abandon the strategic doctrine it has pursued for more than a century, which is not to concede strategic control of a major region of the world to another single power. The reassertion of the continuity of that American strategic policy was a very significant aspect of President Obama's Canberra speech. So based on these perspectives, which have no special wisdom but are purely subjective, my view is that US-China relations in the period ahead will be marked more by complexity, challenge and uncertainty than by disorder and confrontation, and more by cooperation on some issues and competition on others than by crisis or conflict. I don't see a concert of power or other form of institutionalized shared leadership between China and the United States as either necessary or desirable or practical. And I don't see the conditions for such power sharing as existing or in prospect in either China or the US. What do the changes in the international system that I've spoken about, as well as the changing relativities of power between the US and China, mean for Australia's national security interests and the priorities of our policy making? On the Australia-US relationship, I believe the forces of change that I've described reinforce the need for a strengthened alliance relationship that builds on the vital common interests we share across a range of issues, but that recognises different independent national priorities in relation to others. The Australia-US alliance is built on many shared values, but it is not predicated, never has been predicated, and never can be predicated on any complete identity of interests. The US will certainly seek more commitment and engagement from its allies and security partners in the period ahead than it has in the past. Furthermore, for reasons of our own national interest, Australia will need to expand our own self-reliant defence capabilities in the period ahead as well. And for Australia, these two realities, alliance expectations and the need for greater self-reliant defence capacity, will be very difficult, if not impossible, to achieve in the future at levels of defence expenditure that exist today in Australia. President Obama's recent speech to the Australian Parliament was notable in many ways, but it has, in my view, been misinterpreted in some connections. The speech was not reflective of a containment strategy against China in any sense of that term. In fact, for more than 30 years, the United States has been pursuing and is continuing to pursue entirely the opposite strategy, namely to facilitate China's productive engagement in the global economy and in regional and global institutions. The Obama speech restated a commitment to long-standing American priorities in strategic cooperation, economic openness, and human rights. To that extent, it emphasized constructive continuity rather than any radical departure. And in terms of the US-Australia alliance, the speech committed to a significant evolution in training and operational arrangements, but not, in my view, in any provocative way of brinkmanship. The guiding light for Australian policy, it seems to me, in the Asia-Pacific region should be not on the search for strategic equivalence, but on the promotion of stability, transparency, confidence-building measures, cooperative activities, and effective machinery for crisis management if and when such crises may eventuate. I believe that Australia can continue to strengthen its alliance relationship with the United States at the same time as it develops deeper associations of interest with China. And those associations of interest with China include trade and investment flows to maximise our economic complementarities, as well as cooperation on wider regional and global issues. China has an increasingly distinctive and increasingly powerful influence on the management of those issues, and it is vitally important for Australian interests that our bilateral cooperation with China reflects that reality. We need new and innovative ways to achieve that outcome, and I hope and trust that the white paper led by Ken Henry will contribute to that deliberation. Of course, the priorities for Australian national security policy making extend well beyond our relations with the US and China. Japan will remain a key economic and strategic partner in the Asia-Pacific region over the period ahead. Japan is rightly focused on the reconstruction and challenges it faces following the tsunami and earthquake. It's also grappling with very high levels of volatility in its domestic politics. But for all of that, Japan remains the world's third largest economy, with the sixth or seventh largest defence budget in the world. It's an alliance partner of the United States, and it's a critically important strategic and economic partner for Australia. Australia's interests clearly lie in Japan retaining an active regional and global engagement, and in further strengthening our own bilateral economic, diplomatic and defence linkages. Those outcomes need a central focus and high activism from policymakers. India's economic rise, its strategic influence, including in the Indian Ocean, its evolving relationship with the United States, and its regional and global involvement in organisations make it a natural strategic partner for Australia. To date, we've engaged in significantly upgraded cooperative activities with India. We've established potentially very important and productive framework agreements. But in practice, we have barely scratched the surface of the potential in this relationship. The recent decision to sell Australian uranium to India will remove an irritant in the relationship and hopefully act as a catalyst for the acceleration of economic, diplomatic, defence and wider cooperation. Australia's national security interests will also be increasingly served by further developing strategic cooperation with other emerging significant powers in the Asia-Pacific, and particularly with South Korea and Indonesia. We share much in common with South Korea as liberal democracies, as middle powers, as actively engaged countries in regional and global diplomacy, as complementary economies, as US allies, and as nations for each of whom China is the major trading partner. Similarly, Indonesia will also loom even larger in Australia's international priorities over the coming years. Indonesia's democratic stability, its economic development, and its constructive internationalism will matter critically and increasingly for Australian interests. And I think building habits of diplomatic, economic and security cooperation with Indonesia will be indispensable. And I think this is true not only at the government-to-government level, where so much has been achieved over the past decade, but at the people-to-people level, where far more needs to be achieved. The South Pacific region will also engage Australia's economic, security and development interests and responsibilities in an increasingly significant way over coming years. The Pacific Island states themselves face significant challenges in relation to economic development, political stability, social cohesiveness and climate change. And I think building opportunities and enhancing stability in this region will remain an important national interest for Australia and a very testing national challenge for us. Australia's national security interests have never been defined by geography alone, and I think that's even truer today than it's been in the past. Our abiding regional priorities coexist with our critical ongoing global interests. And those interests take many forms. They include effective action in support of open international trade and investment. They include safeguarding against the impact of the greatest crisis in the European Union since its establishment. They include international cooperation to counter the global reach of extremist violence and terrorism. And they include recognising the critical importance for Australian interests of stability in the Middle East and in South Asia. I'd like to conclude by focusing on a theme that I addressed at the outset of my remarks. I spoke earlier about the importance of perspective in identifying continuity and change in Australia's strategic circumstances. I think perspective is also vital in assessing the balance of continuity and change in Australian foreign policy making. In his 2003 Boyer Lectures, one of Australia's most perceptive thinkers in this area, Owen Harries, identified three main traditions in Australian foreign policy: a realist tradition, a liberal internationalist tradition, and a regionalist tradition. The Australian realist tradition was most prominently epitomised by Sir Robert Menzies, with its emphasis on power, national interest and alliances, and with its scepticism of multilateralism and grand themes based on it. The Australian liberal internationalist tradition was most characterised in the first instance by Dr. H.V. Evatt, with its emphasis on Australia's independent middle power credentials and on the relevance of international law and international institutions for Australian interests. And the Australian regionalist tradition was really first epitomised in the 1950s and 1960s by the Australian Ministers of External Affairs, Percy Spender and Richard Casey, with its emphasis on the consequences of decolonisation in Asia, the Colombo Plan, other regional development assistance programs, and Australia's active engagement in regional defence, diplomatic and economic cooperation. None of these three Australian foreign policy traditions are owned exclusively by the major political traditions in Australia. They have evolved over time to reflect Australia's changing strategic environment. They are not adopted or abandoned in any wholesale way with changes of the political cycle, nor are they mutually exclusive, with elements of each having become interconnected in different ways at different times. Australian governments over recent decades have reflected in different ways, and certainly in varying combinations, some elements of the three main traditions of Australian foreign policy. It seems to me that over time, Australian foreign policy has been marked far more by continuity than by change. And this continues to be the case today. There are many broad areas of past and ongoing consensus across the main political traditions in terms of achieving and advancing Australian security, prosperity and values in international affairs. For example, there's consensus on the pursuit of both our regional priorities and our global interest. There's consensus on the need for effective and expanding engagement with Asia. There's consensus in the ongoing and, in key respects, increasing relevance of the Australia-US alliance. There's consensus on the ongoing expansion of Australia's development assistance programs. And there's a recognition of the direct connection between Australia's international economic competitiveness and our potential for influence in international affairs generally. These are important elements of common ground in the pursuit of Australia's national security interests. There are, of course, differences of emphasis on issues such as the appropriate balance between bilateralism and multilateralism, between regionalism and globalism, in the pursuit of Australia's interests. There are differences over some of the means, more than the ends, of Australian foreign and security policy. And there have been, and there will continue to be, differences of response to specific issues, such as border security at the present time, and to international crises as they occur. These differences are not insignificant, but they need to be seen in the context of the broader consensus on key Australian foreign policy priorities and national security priorities to which I refer. Australian foreign policy and national security policy are notable over time for the way in which successive governments have built on the work of their predecessors. Despite some occasional rhetoric, Australian foreign policy and our national security tradition has not been one of dramatic policy U-turns and radically competing visions pursued by governments of different political persuasions at different times. In my view, that has been a great asset for Australia. The past and current differences of perspective and emphasis are significant, and they contribute to the vibrancy of the foreign policy and national security debate. But the common ground has been even more important. In my view, Australia's foreign policy and national security policy are at their best when they acknowledge that reality, when they focus on practical outcomes for Australia, when they distinguish between movement and progress, when they build incrementally on what has been achieved for Australian interests in the past, and when they respond creatively, both to the realities of continuity and to the dynamics of change. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. That was a wonderful canter across the issues confronting us in the national policies security field. We have 10 minutes or so for questions. So if we can... if you have a question, will you please raise your hand? There's a roving microphone. And state your name, where you're from, and your question to Michael. Thank you.
You began by going back 18 years. I think that was a few different years, but you came back that long. But I'll let you go back 70. That is the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and December 1941 is the last time that the United Nations declared war on another. Out of the first aspect, Pearl Harbor, where we got involved in war without really understanding what our major allies were about. Is it satisfactory now that we're the only country committed to going to war alongside the United States if there should be hostilities over Taiwan? Now to the second aspect, that we've been going to war pretty regularly for the last 70 years without an actual declaration of war, do we need to adapt the procedures to give Parliament greater say in the executive decision about the war and sending troops overseas?
Thanks, Gary, for a few milestones that occurred today. I should actually mention that it's also, in addition, Jim Short's birthday, which is probably not as significant, but it's getting up there. Gary, you always ask curly questions because you know so much about these issues. I'm not entirely sure that there has been a categorical undertaking by any Australian government that under any circumstances Australia would go to war with the United States over Taiwan. I may have missed something recently, but I'm not sure that we've written a blank cheque in quite that categorical a way. Some people may link up certain dots and make conclusions, but I don't think it's been as categorical as that irrespective of any circumstance Australia would be on board with the United States. But having said that, I think an alliance is different to a security association. I think it does imply obligations and commitments that are serious, and that it does imply support in difficult times. I wouldn't want to be committed to support another country in any circumstances at any time. But I would be prepared to say that there's more likely to be good reason to support an ally than there would be to support another country in difficult circumstances. On the other question about the role of Parliament in engagement in conflict, I think this is a matter that is continuing to evolve. I don't think there's an answer to this that is right for all time. I think we're seeing a lot of issues evolving at the moment. But in terms of my opinion at the moment, and this is not to say that this won't continue to move, I think there is still a quite sound argument for executive government in democracies to make necessary decisions in terms of their national security and to be held accountable for them. I think there are some procedural issues of delay and other difficulties that parliamentary endorsement prior to any engagement may concede to those who would wish us harm. So I'd need to be convinced that the processes could be as streamlined as the current ones, but at the moment I think that in a democracy executive decision making still has a role and it will be held accountable as it has.
Council member, I've recently read George Bush's book, and he mentions Australia and John Howard, hardly at all. And he's a president who generally likes Australians and generally likes George Bush, which made me think that, or the fact that outside of our immediate region, we really don't matter much. I know that's a bit of a saying, we really don't matter much, but what it means is that the major powers don't really place much weight on it. So, could you comment on that?
I think that's I think it's an understandable conclusion to draw. It's not been my experience in terms of involvement in government, and I don't think it's a matter of the Americans or anybody else being nice to us. I think we do underrate our own capacities in that very deprecating Australian way, sometimes to our own detriment. I think it does sell us short. And certainly if what you said is true, then it is it actually should be a matter of some significant national shame that it's happened. Because we are actually, in terms of whichever measure you take, economic potential, productivity, defence expenditure, diplomatic activism, a significant country. And we shouldn't be so deprecating that we actually write ourselves off. But my experience, certainly in London, and dealing with the Americans over an extended period of time, is that, sure, there are significant differences of scale. But in terms of perspectives that we can offer, particularly on our own region, I think that it is valued, and I think it is sought, and it's probably never going to be clearly able to be demonstrated in books or articles, but it does exist, and I'm not trying to overstate it either. There's obviously delusions of grandeur that we can all get involved in here, and I don't want to go that path, but I think we can go to the other extreme and basically say we don't really matter at all. We do, and I think it's right that we do matter, because I think we bring a lot to the table, and I think in our own region we bring a significant weight.
Yeah. I'm afraid this is going to have to be our last.
Thank you very much, Sarah Wells. I'd like to ask you about our bid for seat on the Security Council, and whether you, following on from your previous comments, think it's going to have any significant bearing on perceptions of Australia's contribution to global security issues, whether we win or lose the seat.
I think it would certainly help if we win, and I'm not quite sure where we're at in that count at the moment, but. Is this worth doing? I believe strongly that it is. I think if you believe in the United Nations as a system, you rely on many of its resolutions in terms of actions you take or sanctions you impose or views you express. I think it's right that every 20 or 25 years you put your hand up to serve on the Security Council. I think it's part of the dues you owe an organisation of this kind. It's a frustrating organisation in many ways, and many people in this room would feel that frustration in terms of the high ambitions at its creation. But it still achieves good in the world, not as much as people may want, but it still achieves a purpose and a role in the world which no one else, no other organisation can. And so, mindful of its shortcomings, I think people have to support it as strongly as they can. Australia has supported this organisation from the start in a very prominent way, starting back with Dr. Ebert, working through. I do think this is one of those occasions where we should offer ourselves. I hope very much it's successful, and I think it would be a good thing for Australia if it is. I think it would be difficult if it doesn't happen.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. And before you flee from the microphone, let me thank you very much on everybody's behalf. It was an extremely, extremely thought-provoking, stimulating talk, and gives us something to take away and think about over Christmas. Thank you very much. And while we're on the topic of what you might take away and think about over Christmas, first of all, our program for next year is well under plan. On the 1st of February, we are hoping to have a talk by Dr. Sally Totman of Deakin University, who's an expert on the Arab world. She's a lecturer in Arab and Middle East studies, and she'll be talking about the Arab Spring. Or is it summer, or is it winter? We will then have a speaker. We are hoping to have a speaker to talk about the uranium sales issue. The following week, we have Professor Harper talking about global economic issues. And a week after that, we have Professor Scrowe of Deakin University speaking on the Italian economy and the implications for Europe of developments in Italy. The second thing to take away, if any of you are as terrified of the European crisis as I am, it may help if I share with you an explanation that was sent to me by email recently about how it all came about. And the story is this. Well, it's an indicative story. A small municipality in Spain decided to twin with a small municipality in Greece. The Greek mayor made a visit of courtesy to the Spanish mayor. And he found when he got there that it was a very pretty place. There was a gorgeous building on top of a hill, which he was taken to, and he said, "What is this building?" And the mayor said, "This is my residence." And he said, "My goodness, they must pay you a lot in Spain." And he said, the Spanish mayor said, "You see that bridge over there?" There was a bridge going over a gorge. And he said, "Yes." He said, "The European Union offered us funds to build a 4-lane bridge over that gorge. But we decided we'd put a 1-lane bridge over the gorge with a red light at either end, and we used the rest of the money to build this house." He said, "Well," the next year, the Spanish mayor made a trip to Greece to call on his Greek counterpart. And guess what? He found that the Greek mayor had a magnificent residence, like the Parthenon, marble everywhere, columns everywhere, gold taps, you name it. And he said to the Greek mayor, he said, "Well, you like my house." He said, "But this is fantastic. This is absolutely incredible. How did you do it?" And the Greek mayor turned to him and he said, "See that bridge over there?" And the Spanish mayor said, "No." So on that note, I wish you all a highly festive season, and we look forward to catching up with you early in the new year. Thank you very much.